My next guest, David Rooney, is a man whose relationship with time runs long and deep. When he was eight, his parents set up a business making, restoring clocks in their home in the northeast coast of England. David went on to become a respected horologist, like his parents. He ended up at the Royal Observatory in Greenwich, the official curator of timekeeping. David's also served as a steward of the Worshipful Company of Clockmakers, which is a delightful title. He sits on the management committee of the Clockmakers Museum, the oldest clock and watch museum in the world. Now, he's an author, several books, including Spaces of Congestion and Traffic and Mathematics, How It Shaped Our World. It was inevitable that one day he would end up writing about his passion for all things horological, a pastime, you might say. And his new book is About Time, A History of Civilization in 12 Clocks. And he's on the line now from his home in London. David, welcome.
Thanks very much for having me on.
I'm trying to think of a single idea that removed humankind so subtly yet irrevocably from the rhythms of the natural world and the keeping of time.
It's hard to think of something other than clocks which has done that. And the level to which that has happened in the last 100 years or so is really astonishing. I mean, if we think about how we measured time, how we saw our position in the universe, which is what measuring time really is, by the rotation of the Earth, has been something that humans have done since right from the start. And they've made clocks, time-keeping devices, for many thousands of years. And yet through history, those technologies made by people for all sorts of reasons have moved us away, as you say, from those natural cycles to the point today where clocks are way more accurate than the Earth itself and are doing some really terrifying things in our lives.
That is such an interesting idea because, as you say, time is the rotation of the planet. Time is the planet orbiting the sun. Time is all those things of the natural world. To have time which is of another realm, which is, as you say, more accurate than those celestial movements, is it a disturbing idea?
I mean, I think it's quite a profound statement to make, which is that what even is time? How can somebody like me say that there are clocks now more accurate than the Earth when the Earth is has been for since time immemorial, our measurement of time? And so the kind of the research for this book took me into so many realms to do with human civilizations, to do with power and control and what technologies can do for us, which certainly left me scratching my head.
Let's take that back then. And as you say, you look at this through timepieces. Time will prevent us from considering them all, but let's go to where you kick off your book with the first sundial erected in Rome. What was the story of that?
Well, we might think of sundials as ornaments or as practical instruments, simply for measuring time. And I was interested in looking much more broadly than just the function of telling time. In the book, I use the word clock to mean any technology that's ever been made to measure the passage of time. Mm-hmm. So sundials and water clocks come into that. And the first water clocks over 3,500 years old, first sundials probably about 3,500 years old. Actually, ancient Rome was quite late to the party. They got their first public sundial in the year 263 BCE, so like 2,200 years ago. And it was set up on a tall column at the heart of Rome in the Forum, where all the most famous speeches of Rome were made. And I was interested in first of all, why was it put there, but also what did it mean to Romans?
Yes, what does that represent?
And when it came to Rome in 263 BCE, it wasn't there as a practical device. It was a war trophy for the returning military general, Manius Valerius Maximus, who'd had a huge victory on the island of Sicily in the First Punic War, where he captured the city of Catania, and he brought back as one of the war trophies this sundial from Catania, and then set it up on this column with which bore his name. And it was kind of to say, you know, I am in power, I am the authority, and you will kind of look up to me in a way I think that we look up to clock towers right up to the present.
How did the Roman citizenry react to that?
They didn't react very well, is the short answer to this. And it's not just kind of an assumption there, because very soon after that first public sundial was installed, many more were installed across Rome. And very soon, the people of Rome were not happy with the effects that these sundials had on their lives. There's a wonderful quotation from just a few years after that first sundial was put in place. A playwright made a character exclaim, "The gods damn that man who first discovered the hours, who first set up a sundial here, who has smashed the day into bits for me." And he went on to say, I was a boy, my stomach was the only sundial. It used to warn me when to eat, but now I can't eat unless the sun says so. And he said that the town is now, this is Rome, is so stuffed with sundials that people are crawling along, shriveled up with hunger. And I always felt that sounded like such a modern complaint to make about clocks, right? We can't have our lunch until the clock allows us. But there it was, 2,200 years ago.
Was this the first, I mean, you say the Romans were late to the party in terms of, you know, the presence of timepieces, but as a public, these are public equipment. Is that where this sort of the public clock, is it where this begins?
Well, I'd never thought about it like this until I was thinking through the ideas in this book. We're familiar with clock towers, public clocks on tall towers or on public buildings and churches and cathedrals and wherever. And I was, and then at the same time, I was looking at this public sundial and seeing that it was installed on a tall column, not on a wall or somewhere close at hand. And I suddenly had this moment where I thought, hang on, that sundial was performing the same purpose as clock towers do. Of course, they tell us the time, but they're doing something more than that. They're kind of standing in for the people who are in power, I think. And that might sound a little bit fanciful, but the idea of clock towers standing for the people who are ruling over us, saying, you know, I'm here and you will kind of, I'll keep you in order and you will do what I say, which is what clocks do. They command us. I felt that we should see that ancient Roman sundial just like we see clock towers today.
I mean, the time is a proxy for the sun in a way. It's so, you know, to You as a person in power, by doing that, by placing this clock on your prominent place, are substituting yourself for the sun. You are taking that sort of celestial presence.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. And some of the earliest clocks were water clocks, and they were pretty simple bucket shaped devices, a vessel for carrying water, and there would be a hole drilled at the bottom. Water would slowly drip out. And you'd have scales on the inside that would show you the passage of time. And they're over 3,500 years old. But as time went on, those water clocks, which horological historians have not tended to look at as much as geared, weight-driven mechanical clocks, these water clocks got to a level of astonishing complexity. And it was to do with the idea of representing the universe, the sun and the heavenly bodies here on Earth, as you say. There were some really remarkable automaton water clocks made in the Islamic world in the medieval period. I talk about one that was made in 1206 for the king of Diyarbakir, which is in today's Turkey. And he had this clock. It hasn't survived, but a very precise description of it has survived, and a picture of it. It was twice the height of a human being, and it had this astonishing array of astronomical automaton figures, like the sun and the moon would move at their proper pace through the sky, and there was a star field with the zodiac signs backlit that would rotate at the right speed, And there were drummers and trumpeters and cymbal players, and falcons would flap their wings. And that was 1206. And if you, I mean, that was made for a royal palace, but there were similar ones made for mosques and for madrasas throughout the Islamic world. And it was saying, you know, this is God's universe here on earth, a replica here on earth, to kind of to allow you to wonder at that remarkable creation. And you can imagine how awe-inspiring that must have been.
A strong lead here taken by the Islamic world in developing this kind of technology, perhaps in line with their sort of interest in mathematics and things of that order.
That's right. The work that that Islamic, what we might now call scientists or engineers, certainly thinkers, taking learning from the ancient world, but then developing it in some remarkable ways, many centuries before some of these ideas came up in the West. I mean, the idea of what most people think of in the West as a clock, this geared, weight-driven mechanical clock, invented in Europe in the 13th century, about 1275. Well, there were large-scale, water-driven, complex clocks showing these most astonishing astronomical indications centuries before that in the Islamic world.
Now, in your book, you describe visiting Siena to see a 14th century fresco. Why is that so significant?
I visited Siena to visit the Palazzo Pubblico in the central square of Siena. And I went to see this fresco, a wall painting, a huge wall painting. It was painted in 1338 by the artist Ambrogio Lorenzetti. And when you stand there, there are three walls of the room are covered in frescoes, right up to the ceiling. And in the center, bathed in the strongest light from the window, there's all kinds of figures. And one of them is the one I went to see, which is the figure of the virtue of temperance. Temperance, like a life lived carefully ordered, not to excess. And what she's holding in her hand in this picture from 1338 is a sand glass, an hourglass, what we might think of as those plastic kitchen timers for timing the cooking of eggs.
Yes.
But this fresco in Italy is the oldest known depiction in the world of a sand glass. And I went to see it because, you know, I'm interested in sand glasses and other technologies. but what it was saying was what was important, because by putting that hourglass in the hands of temperance, it was using this clock to exhort people of the 14th century to live better lives on earth. And then very soon after that, as we kind of remember today, the hourglass got associated with time itself in the hands of Father Time, this bearded, winged man carrying an hourglass. And then soon after that, it became associated also with death, with the end of our lives. And when you think about it, looking at a sand glass, you're looking at a finite lifespan. You can see clearly that the sand may be running, but there'll be a time when those sands run out. And by associating that technology, that clock, with these really powerful ideas about how to live your life better on Earth, because you never know, you know, when it'll end, and it will end for all of us, that became a very powerful symbol through the centuries that followed. And actually, it was when the book manuscript was in the hands of my editor, and he was talking to me about this idea, and he said, you have realized, haven't you, that all of the banners and placards of groups like Extinction Rebellion, who are campaigning for us to live better on Earth now because otherwise extinction awaits us, the symbol is an hourglass. So right up to the present, perhaps without knowing it, the power of that symbol of the hourglass, meaning live a better life. So these are ideas of right and wrong, good and bad, all associated with clocks. And it was trying to understand what clocks mean that really kind of drove me for this project.
It's so beautifully deep. I want you to go, though, to the coming of the train and the necessity of the timetable. And correct me if I'm wrong, it's companion development, Greenwich Mean Time.
That's right. And the story of the railways and time and clocks is a story about standardization. And again, that question of what time actually is. We've been moving away, as we discussed earlier, we've been moving away and away and away from like whatever like real time is. And it used to be the case that the time where you were was the local time according to the sun. But as the railways started to be built, particularly east-west running railways, where the time at each station stop on the line would differ, sometimes just by a few minutes, but I mean, in large countries, you know, it would be several hours. Whose time do you put on the timetable? And so the railway companies realized early on, you know, we need to just pick one time and just use that across our whole network.
That would be useful.
Because nobody's going to know where they are or when they are. And in the UK, in Britain, most of them chose Greenwich, London, because their headquarters were in London, and Greenwich was the nearest observatory. At the same time as the railways were built, the electric telegraphs started to be built, which allowed time to be transmitted at the speed of light through telegraph wires as pulses of electricity. And what that meant was you could have one clock in Greenwich, keeping time according to the sun and the stars above Greenwich, but it could transmit its time anywhere effectively on Earth that you could run a cable, and therefore standardizing the time kept in places far away to the time at Greenwich. And the railways really caught on with this fast, and by about the 1850s, pretty much all the railways in the UK and in many other countries had decided to standardize.
Extraordinary things. I mean, they are such big ideas. The big idea that's about to confront us is the PIPs here at the ABC. Before time defeats us, tell us as a closing idea about the clock of the long now.
This is a project that I kind of wanted to conclude the book with. It's a wonderful project. It's a real mechanical clock that's currently being built in Texas. And a prototype had been made in the year 1999, and then in 2000 it moved to the London Science Museum, where I used to work, and I used to have I used to caretake it. And what it is a clock which can keep time for 10,000 years, if properly maintained and cared about, which is kind of as far into the future as far as 10,000 years in the past was when people sort of settled into farming and. Some say civilization started to begin. But really, it's just a conversation starter. It's trying to make long-term thinking commonplace rather than exceptional. And it's really changed my life. Because 21 years ago, when I started being associated with that project, I realized, as many other people have, we've got to think further into the future to make better decisions now.
And yet implied in that is this an idea that nags at me, that in 10,000 years the assumption is that our idea of time, our idea of our progress through the universe will be the same as it is today, 10,000 years hence.
And in many ways I see the clock project as a challenge. It's a challenge for us to think these ideas through. What kind of time systems and time cultures do we want to have in 10,000 years, but also in 1,000 years, in 10 years? Are the clocks that we've got in our lives now and the effects that those clocks have on us, which is all to do, as I talk about power and money and control and politics in this widest sense, are they the clocks we want? Is this the world we want? You know, we can choose to make some course adjustments. And when we're thinking over that long term, you start to see, well, those course adjustments now might have a major effect in the future. And it's true, we might have a very different culture of time in 10,000 years. But that conversation needs to really start now.
David, sadly, that is all we have time for. But I thank you for the time you have given. What tremendous insights in that. Thank you so much.
It's been a huge pleasure, Jonathan. Thank you.
David Rooney is an historian, curator and author, and his new book is About Time, A History of Civilization in 12 Clocks, published by Viking. And if this is your subject, the Philosopher's Zone here on Radio National, currently running a series on time, which you may want to check out, the ABC Listen app, of course.